This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Brad Pitt. I think you've probably heard of him. He's starring in the new movie Moneyball, which is adapted from Michael Lewis's best-selling book about Billy Beane, the general manager of the Oakland A's. Among Pitt's many other movies are Tree of Life, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Inglourious Basterds, Burn After Reading, Ocean's 11, Seven, Fight Club, and Legends of the Fall. When Moneyball begins, Billy Beane recognizes that his team doesn't have the money the big teams like the Yankees do, and therefore he can't compete in bidding wars for star players. Beane decides to use statistical analysis to figure which players have the assets his team needs, and he ends up going after players that other managers consider too old, too injured, or too mediocre. But Beane believes he understands their unique talents and knows how to put them to use. Pitt plays Billy Beane. Brad Pitt first got noticed in the film Thelma and Louise. Let's start with a scene from Moneyball. Beane has recruited a number-crunching economist from Yale, played by Jonah Hill, to conduct statistical analyses of players. Based on that, they've started trading players and changing the lineup, but without informing the field manager, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. Here's the three of them meeting before a game.
All right, you got a minute?
Yeah. Take a seat.
You can't start Pena first tonight. You'll have to start Hatterberg.
Yeah, I don't want to go 15 rounds, Billy. The lineup card is mine, and that's all.
Okay, the lineup card is definitely yours. I'm just saying you can't start Pena first.
Well, I am starting him at first.
I don't think so. He plays for Detroit now.
You traded Pena.
Brad Pitt, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to make?
Thank you.
Why did you want to make this movie, Moneyball?
Several reasons. I first picked up the book by Michael Lewis and was taken with these guys who, out of necessity, had to challenge conventional wisdom of their industry. I never looked at sports from the economic standpoint, and they are a team. We deal with the Oakland A's in 2002, and they are a team who had a payroll of $38 million to platoon a team, and they're playing against teams that have $120 million with another $100 million in reserves. And there is no way to have an equal fight. And so what these guys had to do was re-question baseball knowledge. They had to take everything apart and start over again.
You know, Billy Beane really loves winning, hates losing, but he can't watch the game. Like, his team is playing and he can't watch. And I think that's because there's so many games in the season and it's so incremental, but I think he just can't bear the suspense of it either. Do you relate to that at all?
I do relate to that. He describes it as not wanting to make an emotional decision, that when he watches, he gets too involved and he wants to be able to he wants to understand the process and the outcome of that process. And then make a clear, level-headed decision afterwards. And for me, I mean, I guess I certainly watched the films during the editing process, certainly on the producerial end, over and over again. And I can distance myself from the actor up there. I know when something's working or when it's not working.
It's a very like dialogue-driven film, even though there's a lot of like baseball scenes in it. But your performance, even though you're basically sitting in a chair talking and making phone calls, your performance is very kinetic. You always seem to be moving, you know, chewing ice, eating, moving your hands, throwing something. Is it challenging to do a kinetic performance in what is basically, you know, a managerial position kind of role?
You know, Billy's that way. Watching Billy, as soon as the phone rings, he becomes very myopic and laser-guided, and he himself becomes very intense. And when you approach a scene, I guess you're coming from the inside and the need to accomplish something, and that manifests itself in certain movements and eating and the need to you know, keep clawing till you get the answer you're looking for.
So Bennett Miller, who directed Moneyball, did a documentary called The Cruise, and he directed Capote, the biopic about Truman Capote that Philip Seymour Hoffman starred in. Of course, Hoffman is also in Moneyball. But did he give you any advice about playing a real person since he'd been through that one time before?
No, we talked more about getting the book to the screen. Listen, Bennett Miller was a great asset to this film, and the thing that's usually overlooked is the tone of a film, and what you see up on the screen is completely his creation, and I just think he's one of the greats. But we talked, you know, the book is very dense. It's dealing with economics and sabermetrics and not necessarily edge-of-your-seat kind of stuff. At the same time, there's this story of underdogs and of value and people getting a chance who have been overlooked and what is our own idea of success and failure. And he was able to bring these human elements to the front of the story.
Let's talk about some of your other films. Let's start with Inglourious Basterds, Quentin Tarantino's recent film. It's set during World War II, and you play Lieutenant Aldo Raine, who's charged with putting together a team of, like, real killers to kill the Nazis. So here you are explaining the mission to your team.
My name is Lieutenant Aldo Raine, and I'm putting together a special team, and I need me 8 soldiers. 8 Jewish American soldiers. Now, y'all might have heard rumors about the Armada happening soon. Well, we'll be leaving a little earlier. We're going to be dropped into France dressed as civilians. And once we're in enemy territory, as a bushwhacking guerrilla army, we're going to be doing one thing and one thing only. Killing Nazis. Now, I don't know about y'all, but I sure as hell didn't come down from the goddamn Smoky Mountains, cross 5,000 miles of water, fight my way through half of Sicily, and jump out of a f***ing aeroplane to teach the Nazis lessons in humanity. Nazi ain't got no humanity. They're the foot soldiers of a Jew-hating, mass-murdering maniac, and they need to be destroyed. That's why any and every sumbitch we find wearing a Nazi uniform, they're gonna die.
That's Brad Pitt in a scene from Inglourious Basterds. I like the way you say Nazis.
That's tasty stuff. Only from the mind of Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, you know, when I interviewed him on the show, he was talking about how he thinks of his dialogue writing as being like poetry or lyrics or rap. And he didn't mean that in an arrogant way. He just meant to say that he wants there to be a rhythm to the writing and a rhythm in the way the dialogue is acted. And I was wondering, like, if you talk to him about that at all, if he talked to you about that, and if you find his writing different from most screenwriting.
Yes, it's it was evident on the first read. There is a cadence and I would say a music to his dialogue. And what you heard there is exactly what I heard when I first read the script. It defines itself, and you just sing along.
Did the script say to pronounce Nazis Nazis?
No, it didn't say that, but we're from the same general neck of the woods, so we both understood.
Who, you and Lieutenant Aldo Raine, or you and Quentin Tarantino?
Because
he's from L.A., isn't he?
Yeah, but he's originally from Kentucky and has a lot of roots.
Oh, okay.
Kentucky roots.
You have a scar on your neck in the film, and it looks like either you were strangled with a wire and survived, or your throat was slashed and you survived. Do you know what happened to your throat?
Yes, and he said it would never be explained in this film, and if he's ever to do what he called a prequel/sequel, we'll reveal it then.
And is that a possibility?
He talks about it. You know, he's got several things percolating at once.
So let's, in our little mini film festival, move on to Burn After Reading, which is written and directed by the Coen brothers. And you play a kind of goofy personal trainer at a gym called Harbodies, where Frances McDormand's character also works. And she's been trying to get enough money to have some cosmetic surgery done. And you see an opportunity when you find a computer disc that's been left behind by one of the customers in the locker room. And you think the disc has top secret government information. What you don't know is that what it really has is the first draft of a memoir by a former CIA analyst. In this scene, you go to Frances McDormand's home to tell her you found out the name of the CIA guy. And later, you suggest that you can blackmail him and tell him that you have the disc and you can give it back to him for a price. So here you are when you first walk into Frances McDormand's home with the name of the CIA guy.
Oh, my God.
Do you know what time it is?
Uh-huh. So if I couldn't call you on your totally unsecured phone, but I know who the guy is.
The guy?
guy, the secret guy.
So is he high up?
I don't know if he's high. Probably. I mean, I got his name, not his rank.
So what's his name?
Osborne Cox.
Never heard of him.
Oh, like, you're so plugged into the intelligence
community. I'm just saying, it's a layperson.
Well, I think the quality of the intelligence dictates how high up he is,
okay.
Not what we know. I also... Do you have any water? I gotta hydrate.
I got tap water.
Are you kidding?
How do you know who he is?
Sources.
What do you mean, sources?
You got, like, Gatorade or anything besides, like, Maryland swamp water? Do you know how far this is from my...
How do you know his name?
I got this geek friend, Eddie Gallegos. He does computer stuff. Hooks up people's computers and programs their VCRs and... So he examines the files and pulls off the digital watermark, which tells you what computer it was created on.
And child's play for Eddie.
Uh-huh.
And I got his number. I got his number.
And with that number, you plan to call the agent and blackmail him. And the agent is played by John Malkovich. It's a really funny film. You seem to really enjoy comedy. Is that fun for you to do?
Absolutely. I enjoy it all. I want to keep mixing it up. And I find that the next film is always informed by the last film you finished. And what cracked me up about this one, besides being a Coen's fan for life, was that here's a guy who is not interested in anything beyond his own neighborhood, that has no intellectual curiosity for the world at large, and you know, almost trapped in his suburban lifestyle and quite happy with it, and thinks things are going to go a certain way and can't imagine they wouldn't go any other way, and when they do, he's quite rattled by it.
So I think we heard a little bit of like clapping in that scene. You're doing this like little dance because you're so excited that you got the name and the number. Was that in the script or did you just kind of put that in?
No, you know, when you're investigating your character, I guess you say, it's always the most fun part of the process. And I just figured he went to a lot of the neighborhood clubs. I figured he was really high on Madonna.
So when you're working with the Coen brothers, who do everything together, they write together, they direct together, or so we're told, how do you know who to talk to when you have a question?
They do work together. They got a really lovely thing going. And you talk to either one of them, and they both confer with each other, and they're not precious about any of it, and you do a couple of takes and move on. One is sitting in the director's chair and one in the producer's chair, but they're both in charge and conferring with each other, and it's a really light kind of family atmosphere. It's really good fun.
You grew up in Oklahoma and in Missouri, and mm-hmm. Your family was Southern Baptist evangelical?
Mm-hmm.
So what,
yeah, we grew up Southern Baptist, and then somewhere in my high school years, my family moved more towards the charismatic movement.
So what was your Christian background like? What was the emphasis like in church? How was that reflected in your upbringing?
Well, it was, you know, it was Sunday school and do good and Bible study and daily prayer. But it was always something I wrestled with personally. I was very curious about the world even at a young age, and I don't know at what point I became aware that... other nations and other cultures didn't believe the same, and they believed in different religions. And my question is, well, why don't they get to go to heaven then? And the answer was always, well, everyone gets a chance, meaning at the word of God as it was described to me then. And that didn't sit right with me. But it, you know, at the same time, in times of trouble or discourse, it's a great comfort. And it wasn't till I left home that I really came to the conclusion it didn't make sense to me for many other reasons than that.
So you know, you mentioned that there's a certain amount of comfort that you take when you have religion in your life. Did you give up a certain amount of comfort when you evicted religion from your life?
Yeah, it's very discombobulating for a period. But... within time, you get comfortable with yourself and acceptance of the unknown, that we're not going to know until that time comes, and that's enough for me. You know, I wrestle with this a lot even now because I don't want to step on anyone's religion. My family's still very dedicated. At the same time, I take great issue with it when it starts defining policy or ultimately becomes separatist, and that's what I see it, and it's been the basis of our main conflicts throughout history.
Now, you describe coming from a home where feelings weren't expressed. Did you have to learn the language of emotion in order to act?
I'm not sure I know how to answer that yet. I wouldn't define this as not knowing how to express, because sometimes what we don't say is more powerful than what we do say, and I find that in the iconic characters on screen.
Mm-hmm.
There is still a communication and a transfer of information.
Now, you studied journalism in college. What did you expect to become?
I wasn't really sure. I was just investigating it for myself. They have one of the best J schools in the country.
Oh, this is where?
University of Missouri.
Okay.
And it just came to the time of graduation, and everyone was all my friends were committing to jobs, and I just realized I was not ready for that yet. And it just occurred to me that having always lamented that there wasn't the possibility or career choice of being in films, that I could go to it. And once I struck that little bit of discovery, I packed up my car. I didn't graduate. I had 2 weeks left. And I moved out to L.A.
Why didn't you finish the 2 weeks? I mean, 2 weeks is such a it's a blink of an eye.
There's a great line in I'm blanking on Spike Jonze's second film with Chris Cooper.
Yeah, it's the Susan Orlean adaptation. It's called Adaptation.
Right. Yeah, Spike's film Adaptation, yeah. And he him being into orchids prior, he was, if I recall right, had a career with fish. And someone asked him why he doesn't do that anymore, and he just says, done with fish. And I felt that way. I just felt I was done. I was done with it.
So you knew your mind.
Well, I knew where I wanted to go. I had a direction. I always liked those moments of epiphany when you have the next destination.
So you go to L.A. and then what? You get there, then what?
I get there with, like the cliche goes, with my beat-up Datsun, and I had $275 to my savings, and I landed in Burbank, and I got the paper, and I found some extra agencies, and by, you know, the end of that week, I paid my $25 to join up, and I was an extra.
In what?
It started out in industrial films and commercials, and then you work your way up, and I guess the biggest film I had was, or I had, that's really, that's a funny way to put it, but it was Less Than Zero.
Oh, you were an extra in Less Than Zero?
Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed
that
man.
That must have been fun. I mean,
it was so much fun. I just wanted to be around film. And suddenly I was on film and I was on a set and watching how the guys, you know, how they do it.
So what films do you love that made you want to be in films yourself?
I loved Saturday Night Fever when I was a kid. I couldn't believe people talked that way. It was just a whole nother culture I didn't understand. I snuck into it. It was an R-rated film, and so it holds a special place. I remember, it's still the films on my playlist today. Would be Dog Day Afternoon. Cuckoo's Nest was a huge one with me. When I would say Strange Love always cracks me up, and Apocalypse Now, another favorite.
So you start getting in films, and you get very famous. What was the strangest thing early on about actually not only being successful but being famous?
The strangest thing is suddenly being looked at and watched and judged in a way. I don't know what I was expecting. You're putting yourself in that ring. I just didn't think that far ahead. And I found it very discombobulating. I was very, very uncomfortable with the focus.
So did that make you want to be in the limelight any more or less?
No, I still wanted to crack this film thing I was in, but I was committed. You know, I think one of the lovely things about where I grew up is it's considered great hubris to talk about yourself. And yet, you know, as we sit here now, it's part of the business. And I find it actually interesting and cathartic in some way. But at that time, I mean, a good 10 years I wrestled with it.
About how much to share about yourself? And
yeah, I was very, very protective.
So you live in a world where money is so weird. I mean, like, you were able to sell the first pictures of the first child that Angelina Jolie gave birth to for $4.1 million to People magazine. And then, you donated the money to charity. You put the money to good use. But that's just, like, so weird to get that amount
it's
of money for
bizarre.
Photograph. It's crazy. It's like value's gone nuts. So
it's bizarre.
Yeah, it seems to me what you're trying to do is, like, at least try to take the value's gone nuts and put it to good use, put the money to good use.
Well, that was my feeling. I mean, I know some of these guys who are in that stalkerazzi world, and you really have to separate them from the paparazzi in our industry. This is another breed. And they have their heroes who got the big scandalous shot, which just promotes more of that. So going into this, we knew, listen, it's a very strange thing to be selling photos of something that's very intimate and personal, and those of which you want to protect. We knew, we have to plan an escape every day to get out of the house, kind of a Mission Impossible with decoys, and that's the life we live in, and that's the one we asked for. So, but we knew there was a bounty on our head, and a huge bounty, and there would we understand the lengths they go to. I don't think people do to get that shot. So we figured, let's cut it off from the beginning, and instead of that money going to people I do not respect, that we would make some good out of it. And there's a nice thing about our situation.
So did it work? Did it head people off at the pass? Did it prevent you from being stalked in the way that you feared you would?
Yeah, it took that initial hit. Absolutely.
So at least nobody else could claim that they had the first photo.
Right. And that's where the big bounty is.
That's where the big bucks are. Right. Mm. I interview people for a living. That's how I spend my time, you know, and I care what my guests have to say. I'm really interested in hearing how the choices people make when they're living their lives, why they do what they do, how they do what they do. At the same time, I don't really understand why everybody needs to know the intimate details of your personal life or your children's lives. And I imagine you don't really understand that either, but it's something you probably have to think about a whole lot more than I do. Do you have any answers to that? Like, why do people feel that they need to know or that they're entitled to know personal details
well,
like
we,
that?
I actually, we, you know, I divorce myself of it. I don't think about it. And as I say, I enjoy life much more.
Mm-hmm.
I recall, you know, I do know there's a positive side to it. Let me put it this way, and let's see if it relates.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I had seen people I respected when I was first starting, just that brush with them meant something to me. Like, my day felt special.
Are there actors you felt that way about when you first met them?
Absolutely. I just, you know, again, just being around it and, like, being on the set of Lesson Zero, I watched Robert Downey Jr. go by, and I thought, yeah, that's all right.
Now, one of the things that you've been doing through your foundation is architectural work in New Orleans, in one parish where there was a lot of destruction from Hurricane Katrina. Are you still involved with that? Is that still an ongoing
mm-hmm.
project?
Yeah, we're still going, and it's exceeded my expectations. We're over halfway through. We'd made a commitment for 150 to get 150 families back in homes there. And it became an important statement for social justice, and I'm very happy, and I'm even more happy to see the families return and make it their own, and for the homes to be working for them as well as they are. I know in like the lower, we take the lower Ninth Ward, and I know This is an area that's been historically marginalized. And for suddenly someone to come along, not just me, but I mean this whole thing, the money was raised from the kindness of strangers. Someone to come along and just to help them up, just give them a break, changes one's outlook on the world. And it's a happy place, and to be able to pass that along, to know that you've been fortunate and know the effect you have. Seeing what we've seen in our travels, I would just I see no other way. What I'm saying is I'm complicit if I don't pass that on.
Mm-hmm. You've said that you and Angelina Jolie will not marry until it's legal for all Americans to marry. And it's a statement in support of marriage equality. So was that always your reason for not marrying? Was that like in other words, like if gay marriage is made legal in the United States, does that mean you're going to marry tomorrow?
That's a fair question. We're getting a lot of heat from the kids, I must say. So I hope we can hold out. But I agree with the statement. I think it's absolute out and out discrimination. I don't understand how you can dictate that. You can put that. You can confine someone else that way. It's life, liberty, and happiness, and that's the country we live in. And let's support that.
So can I squeeze in one more film clip before we have to end?
Yeah, sure.
Great. Okay, so this is Fight Club. And this became a real, like, cult favorite. And you star in this with Edward Norton, and he plays somebody who's been traveling on business, meets your character on a plane, and comes home to find his house has been destroyed. He calls you up, and then you meet in a bar, and then you basically make a strange request to him. You say, hit me. Here's the clip.
What do you want me to do? You just want me to hit you?
Come on. Do me this one favor.
Why?
Why? I don't know why. I don't know. Never been in a fight. You?
No, but that's a good thing.
No, it is not. How much can you know about yourself if you've never been in a fight? I don't want to die without any scars. So come on, hit me before I lose my nerve.
Oh, God. This is crazy.
So go crazy. Let her rip.
Hey, I don't know about this.
I don't either, but who gives a? No one's watching. What do you care?
Wait, what? This is crazy. You want me to hit you?
That's right.
What, like in the face?
Surprise me.
This is so stupid.
Oh. It's my guest Brad Pitt with Edward Norton in a scene from Fight Club. So the character says, how much can you know about yourself if you've never been in a fight? Have you been in fights? I mean, you've had to be in fights for movies. What about real life?
Not really. Not really. Not for a long time, which I'm grateful to say.
But even when you were young, did you?
Oh, certainly in my younger days, and they were always messy and scrappy and somewhat stupid.
Mm-hmm. So did you and Ed Norton end up hurting each other at all during the making of this film?
No, I don't think so. We mainly just had a laugh.
So how many people walk up to you and say, the first rule of Fight Club is not to talk about Fight Club?
No one.
Really?
No.
It's one of those, like, famous lines, which I think I just got a couple of words wrong in, but nevertheless.
Sometimes I'll get Tyler Durden. But nothing much more than that.
What do people say when they meet
I'm
you?
Just afraid, you know, people are doing things to my soup or, you know, the restaurant or something.
Do you have to worry about that?
I try not to.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, I thank you very much.
Brad Pitt stars in the new film Moneyball, based on Michael Lewis's best-selling book about Billy Bean, the general manager of the Oakland A's. Tomorrow, we'll hear the interview I recorded with Michael Lewis about that book. I picked up Dana Spiota's novel Stone Arabia after hearing our book critic Maureen Corrigan's review. She described it as a novel about responsibility, the responsibility artists have to their art, and the responsibility family members have to take care of each other. The story is about a failed rock musician who is now a 50-year-old bartender. But he's never given up on his music. He's kept recording under the name of an alter ego he created. And he's obsessively chronicled this alter ego's imaginary career, writing reviews, profiles, and album liner notes. He collects all this in what he calls the Chronicles. The only person he shares his music with is his sister, who also helps him take care of the practical matters in his life while he inhabits this imaginary world. She's also dealing with depression and their mother, who's losing her memory. Dana Spiota's previous novel, Eat the Document, was nominated for a National Book Award. Let's start with a reading from Stone Arabia. Denise, the sister, is describing her brother Nick's chronicles.
By 2004, Nick had 30-odd volumes of the Chronicles, going back to 1978 officially. Unofficially, they were retrofitted back to 1973 with the rise of the demonics. They were all written exclusively by him. They are the history of his music, his bands, his albums, his reviews, his interviews. He made his chronicles, scrapbooks really, thick, clip-filled things. He wrote under many different aliases, from his fan club president to his nemesis, a critic who started at Cream magazine and ended up writing for the Los Angeles Times. A man who follows and really hates his work. Nick had given him plenty of ink these past few years. Nick's chronicles adhered to the facts and then didn't. When Nick's dog died in real life, his dog died in the Chronicles. But in the Chronicles, he got a big funeral and a tribute album. Fans sent thousands of condolence cards. But it wasn't always clear what was conjured. The music for the tribute album for the dog actually exists, as does the cover art for it. A great black and white photo of Nick holding his dog with an intricate collage along the edge consisting of images of the great canines of history, from Toto to Lassie to Rin Tin Tin. But the fan letters didn't exist. In this way, Nick chronicled his years in minute but twisted detail. The volumes were all there, a version of nearly every day of the past 30 years.
Dennis Biota, welcome to Fresh Air. What interests you about the idea of actually producing the art, in this case, the music, and creating the album covers, and then writing imaginary reviews and building a whole imaginary persona around it? So, you know, like Nick is really doing the art, but everything surrounding it that he's chronicling is fake. What interested you in that idea?
Well, I think what interests me about Nick is that he's able to find a way to be almost completely self-contained. He's providing his own audience, and it's even a critical audience. And I think in this way, he's able to ignore the world as it ignores him. And I think it's a key to his survival to a certain extent. Of course, he does have his sister, and he does have a few other people who actually listen to his music.
You know, a lot of people basically do their work that way. You know, like they write novels that aren't read or make music that nobody hears. But they don't necessarily write reviews of it and have a whole fake alter ego that they've created.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's... My stepfather was the inspiration for this character, and he did this very thing. He had a sort of 30-year chronicle of his life as a fake rock star, and he did it mostly as a laugh, but he kept it up pretty well. And what I found is that it seems to help him not feel bitter or resentful about his not having an official career. So I think that the trick is to do this thing and then to not mind that you're doing it on your own, and to actually revel in that if that is where you end up. And as you say, there are many people who keep their novels and their paintings and their music going, even if they haven't made it in whatever that word means. That was really what I was interested in, is what that feels like 25 years down the road. It's easy to say that when you're 17, I'm going to keep going no matter what. But what is that like when you're 50? What does it feel like for the people around you? You know, what did it cost you? And what did it save you from?
Yeah, no, in your stepfather's case, I mean, mm-hmm. he has a website. I went
mm-hmm.
on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's excerpts of, there's four or five songs on it. He actually plays the music on it. I don't know if the other band members are real people or whether he plays all
no,
the
cards. No,
they are.
Yeah.
They're real people.
Yeah, I exaggerated my character is more fantastical than Richard is, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your novel, Nick, who has this alter ego as a rock star, also writes in the voice of his sister in the Chronicles, because she's a part of his life. So he writes her part.
And uh-huh.
She's somebody who used to be very beautiful when she was young, and now in her late 40s, she's still very attractive. She had wanted to be an actress but didn't succeed. But unlike Nick, who develops this imaginary world to keep performing in, she just kind of gives up acting. And what he writes in her voice in the Chronicles is, Nick's art was his life, and I don't know what that means about a life. I have always resisted artistic impulses of any kind. I always believed that if you weren't good, what right did you have to do it? And I think that's such a fundamental question, if you're not exceptionally talented at something, but it gives you pleasure. Like if you're not good at playing guitar, is it okay to play anyways? If you can't really sing well, is it okay to take singing lessons and sing and devote time to it, knowing that you're never really going to be very good? Was this a question you ever had to ask yourself? You seem very good at writing, so I don't know that you needed to ask yourself about that.
Well, I have had the experience of being a very bad actor.
Really?
But yes, I did try acting when I was in high school, and I was terrible at it. So I definitely have had the experience of being bad at artistic endeavor. And one of the things I avoided talking about in the book a little bit was how good Nick really is at what he does. I mean, I think his chronicles are certainly impressive, but is his music good or not? I mean, there's so much subjectivity to these aesthetic questions, and certainly whether you make it in the world doesn't mean, you know, that good people who are very good at producing music still don't make it and so on, as we all know. So I think that if everyone was secretly an artist, that would be a great thing, I guess is my short answer.
So whereas Nick has, you know, created this whole imaginary life around his art, and he's chronicled every detail of it, his sister Denise is afraid she's losing her memory, that she's in the opposite position, that her past is just kind of vanishing. Her real past is kind of vanishing. And she thinks maybe she's has such bad recall because she threw out too much. Maybe she should have kept more souvenirs from the past. Or maybe she should have had some kind of accounting and not just gotten rid of everything so quickly. So you've created two very different ways of being kind of uncomfortable in the world. one which is like tossing things out, not keeping a record and forgetting. And the other is, you know, just like chronicling every detail, even the imaginary things.
Yeah, well, this is something that became the central concern of the book, which is memory and sort of how and identity and how these things interact. So I think for the character of Denise, her mother is losing her memory and her brother is creating a fake past. And it's putting her in a precarious position in terms of who she is. I think, you know, your family corroborates your memories and you have this sense that when someone you love is losing their memory, that you're sort of, that affects you. You start to feel you're not sure who you are because one of the people who can corroborate your past is gone.
It's so true.
This is how it all started to tie together to me. It sort of happened organically that, of course, Nick's destabilization by making up his own past, he's sort of controlling this thing, which none of us really can control. We may as well make up chronicles because if you and I both experience something, really what we have is what we agree upon. And, you know, there's this phenomenon now that they're called reconsolidation of memory, where they now say that when we remember things, we are actually revising them each time we remember them. We're bringing in things we saw on TV. We're bringing in new information. So we're constantly creating this narrative of our own past, which is not fixed, which is constantly changing. So in a sense, you know, all of these things become very slippery. And this gets very tied in, I think, with her own sense of mortality, that her life itself is slipping away, which it feels like when you get to be that age, you know, my age.
Which is?
45. She's a little older, but yeah.
I'll sometimes call my brother or my very oldest friend in the world and say, did this happen? You know, or what do you remember about this? Because I kind of slightly remember it, but I have no idea what actually happened. Do you? And between the two of us, we can maybe construct it. Do you have somebody to do that with?
Yeah, well, my brother. I have a little brother. And it's disturbing, though, how subjective these things are, because we really do have a small patch that overlaps these radically different stories of what happened. It's very strange.
Now, to write this book, because you're writing in part of it in Nick's voice, and Nick is writing in the voice of various music critics, you had to learn to write like various music critics. And you had to write liner notes and obituaries and reviews. So what kind of reading did you do to get down the different languages that you would need to impersonate the voices you wanted to?
I love this question because that was really so much fun. I do like to do a lot of research. I did read a lot of Lester Bangs, and I read Grail Marcus, and I read a lot of old Cream magazines. You remember Cream magazine from the 70s? And when I was growing up, I read a lot of New Musical Express and Melody Maker, but that's a sort of more British style. I really wanted American. So I was trying to get what Nick would have read, because he has all these kind of rock and roll tropes in his head that had to be from his time period. And then he has these little weird tics. He makes up quotes for people. You know, he makes up a quote from Gloria Steinem, or he makes up a quote from Karl Popper. And because Nick is he's a self-taught guy, a working class guy from Los Angeles, he's very smart. I could do whatever I wanted, really. And that's the joy that Nick takes, is that he can do whatever he wants. And so through him, I got to do whatever I wanted. So in some weird way, I kind of became like Nick Wirth for a moment. And I see it's so great not to have to worry about being derivative or or stealing things from people or getting it wrong. It was really fun.
Did you ever want to be a musician or a musician's girlfriend?
Well, I am a musician's wife, so.
Oh, are you?
My husband is a musician. He cooks and he's a chef, but he also he makes basement recordings. So many people in my life make basement recordings. So I feel very lucky. I'm surrounded by very creative people. But he makes records and then tries to get them out in the world, and he plays out with his band. And, you know, these days with the music industry, it's not like someone's going to discover you and sign you. I mean, you sort of have to make your own records and put them out there and try to get a following.
Go ahead and give him a plug. What's his name? What's the name of his
band? His name is Clement Coleman, and his band is the Methodist Bells, and they're terrific.
Okay.
Thank you.
Since your novel is inspired in part by your stepfather, who created a musical persona for himself, should we end with one of his recordings from his website?
Oh, sure.
I was thinking of By School.
Oh, By School. By School's a great one.
Yeah. Do you want to say anything about this?
This is my stepfather's band made this record. Village made this record is the name of the band. And I believe it's from 1979.
Now, should we maybe segue from give the whole family a plug here? Because everybody, I think, at this point is curious. Should we maybe segue from your stepfather's recording to your husband's, one of your husband's recordings?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Dana Spiota, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Terry. This is really fun.
Shopping town, I gotta stop and look around, check my phone. Walk along the riverside, I feel so cold and so alive, so alone.
We just heard Dana Spiota's stepfather, Richard Frasca, and his band Village, and after that, we heard her husband Clement Coleman and his band The Methodist Bells. You can read an excerpt of Dana Spiota's novel, Stone Arabia, on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Therese Madden. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.